Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
The story you're about to hear on Love, Lust, Fear is true. Some names, places, and other identifying details may have changed to protect the storyteller. Love, Lust, Fear may contain graphic language and depictions of sensitive situations. Please listen with caution. Next on Love, Lust, Fear.
I was in an extremely vulnerable place when I met Leighton. I was in a real crossroads in life. My marriage was breaking down. I was very alone. I was lacking this love, lacking attention, lacking validation. He was so hot and cold. So he would be super charismatic and flirty and then all of a sudden would kind of shift and become quite offhand or even slightly rude. He called me so many names that night and I was just so taken aback. It's the first time I'd ever seen this side. I was a bitch. I was a slut. I was just totally isolated and stuck with him, locked in this bedroom every day. I was just an absolute mess inside and out. My body was shutting down. I shook all day. I shook all day, constantly. I had anxiety attacks constantly. He locked the car doors and he drove off away from my driveway. And he said, "I fooled you. I tricked you." I really thought that he said to me, "I'll fucking kill you. I'm going to fucking kill you." And I thought, okay, I really am going to die here.
Jamie grew up in the chaos of her parents' toxic marriage, one marked by constant conflict and emotional instability. Searching for a way to escape, Jamie discovered dance. It became her lifeline, an outlet where she could channel her pain and find a sense of freedom. As a teenager, Jamie fell into a series of unhealthy relationships that mirrored the dysfunction she had grown up with, but she still yearned for stability and belonging. She believed she had found it when she married a man and spent nearly a decade with him, but as time passed, their connection faded. Jamie was left feeling isolated, emotionally starved, and alone. Now at a crossroads, Jamie soon met a charismatic, handsome man. What began as a spark of hope quickly turned dark. She soon found herself trapped by a master manipulator. The relationship became abusive, emotionally, psychologically, and physically, gradually destroying her self-worth and damaging her health. After multiple attempts to escape, her final effort ended in a dangerous confrontation, where she stared into the eyes of a man ready to take her life.
I think that my first perception of love or a relationship was quite toxic and painful. Both my parents tolerated things that they weren't happy with, which, yeah, made home life quite abusive and scary. My mum and dad, they had a very tumultuous relationship. I think that there was a lot of love, but a lot of dysfunction. They both came into the relationship as dysfunctional people. And so with that, it kind of resulted in two really passionate people and some fantastic times, but also some very scary and traumatic early memories for us kids growing up. So, yeah, a lot of fighting, which definitely traumatized me and my sister when we were young. So my role in the family was always, I was the peacekeeper, even from a very young infant. Standing in between my parents, you know, come on, guys, stop, you know, or trying to appease a situation or de-escalate a situation. You meet my mum, who's a beautiful-looking woman, who would hide these things so well because she is so personable and beautiful to look at and have it all together, quite a strong woman in herself. And then, of course, you'd meet my dad, who is also lovely to look at. He's charismatic. And he's a people person. It's where I get my personability from, I'd say. So separately, individually to each other, these two people were great people. But together, it was just like an atomic bomb going off, you know? And unfortunately, I don't think they had the insight at the time to understand how that affected us little ones. Definitely was something that we hid. It was definitely shameful. And outward appearances, you would never have suspected that there was so much abuse going on in the home. I also experienced childhood sexual assault from a family member. They did do their best to combat this childhood sexual assault. They were very supportive and they got me all the help that I could possibly need and told me every day that I was fantastic and really did build up our self-esteem. Then it was knocked down by the abuse that we saw between the two. And I just think that's so impactful on young minds. And it really shaped my idea of what love looked like. And it set the bar quite low in many ways in terms of what I accepted in a partner. So, yeah, I suppose you accept shitty behavior when your first example of that has been dysfunctional. My first relationship was quite young and very intense, but lovely. And that actually set the bar quite high. He was a lovely guy. But then throughout high school, I had a boyfriend who, yeah, it wasn't good. It was a definite pattern of being mistreated and lied to and just young. I mean, we put it down to being young, but I definitely think I held on. I think I was in that relationship for about 4 years. So through the best years of my teenage years, I stayed with this person who it wasn't a great relationship, wasn't healthy. I had a fantastic group of friends as well at college. And as I was sort of gradually going into like my later teens, 18, was able to go out, I really, really hit the party scene hard. So I'm a fun lover, but I think that was another escape from being at home with parents. I really loved my friends and we partied a lot. We had a great time. Some of it a little self-destructive. I had no inhibition. It was just, oh yeah, it'll be fine. You know, like I've survived worse, I'll be fine. So some of it, I suppose, quite reckless. I had a boyfriend that was mistreating me or whatever. It was like, well, I've watched mum accept that. I've watched dad accept that. This is what we do. This is what happens. You fight and then you make up. That was kind of the kind of toxic thing I had in my head, that this was normal to this reckless kind of tumultuous relationships. So I met this man. I was 20 years old and we got married young, 21 years old I was married. And this was the most stable and normal man I think I'd ever met. We did extremely well. We worked really hard. We owned a lot of property together. We bought a family farm. We traveled, we studied. We had two beautiful boys. And for a long time, I believed that I'd kind of escaped this predicted future of hardship and definitely thought I'd outrun a lot of the demons from my childhood. We bought this farm and we're married, and I think it had been about 8 or 9 years we've been together. And with his work, my husband, he worked away a lot. It was seasonal work. So he would go away for long periods of time. I was at home with the children and I became very lonely, very lost. I was very alone and out of my element. So I'm on a farm and I'm not from a farming background. I'm from the city and I'm just feeling very depressed and unfulfilled in myself. I loved being a mum, but there was just this loneliness. And then he would come home and wouldn't come home and it wouldn't be so great to see you. It was like, okay, well, you haven't done this and you haven't done that. So it kind of became this problem, this kind of unspoken tension between us, like a resentment. He resented having to go away. I resented him going away. This gap sort of happened. And then I think it was in the first lockdown, I went to the doctor and I realized that I had contracted an STI. And obviously I'm the stay-at-home mum, loyal wife, and for me, that was a major turning point in my mindset with my marriage. And it's very hard because I don't have any proof that he was cheating. However, he was away for long periods of time. But I couldn't shake it. I don't think there was any coming back from my perspective. I couldn't come back from it. I felt like I wasn't attracted to him anymore after that. That was it. That was really the final straw. I wanted out of this marriage, expressed that. And I was definitely scared of leaving it because it had been so my most stable thing I'd known in my life. But I also didn't want to stay out of financial safety as I'd watched my mother do this for years, I think. And it didn't work. I'd seen the result of that, and I didn't want to do that to my children. So we decided kind of before tension between us got too far, this was kind of the way that we were going to go. We were looking at ending our marriage. However, I think my husband desperately was clinging on to hope. I don't think he was ready to accept that. I was probably a few steps ahead of him. This is what I wanted to do. And he was quite distraught and struggled with the fact that our marriage was coming to an end. I was in a real crossroads in life. My marriage was breaking down. I was very alone. I was lacking this love, lacking attention, lacking validation. So I think I was in an extremely vulnerable place when I met Leighton. He was a very good-looking guy, and that was also appealing. My first ever interaction with Leighton was very confusing, I remember. Like, quite thrilling, but I left feeling quite confused and perplexed by the whole thing. Like, it really sat in my head. He was so hot and cold. So he would be super charismatic and flirty, and then all of a sudden would kind of shift and become quite offhand or even slightly rude. And I wasn't really sure where I stood, which is strange, but the first time he ever sent me a message, I was like, wow, that was weird. And then, of course, I was ghosted for a few weeks. So I was like, wow, that was odd. And then he came back a few weeks later and it was just all guns blazing. So putting his best foot forward in every way possible, showered me with gifts. So, you know, lots of romantic gestures and gifts. He bought me this really expensive bracelet that was like way expensive and over the top. And I was like, wow, like absolutely lapping this up. This is something that I'd been lacking for years, I'd say at this point. And then all of a sudden he would pull back, which would make me crave the attention that he had been giving me, sort of purposely withdraw love. And seriously, like by the time this sort of pattern had emerged, I would have done anything for him to get that positive attention back. It kind of created like this kind of sick in a way, but a craving and a bond in me that I was kind of chasing this high with him that he had shown me. I remember this one time he was like, let's go out for the night. We'll go and meet some of my friends, get dressed up, and I'll buy you a nice bottle of wine and we'll go out. And so I did. I got all dressed up. And so I come into town and I'm, where are you? You know, I'll come and meet you. And I think he had me on this wild goose chase for about 2 hours. I was trying to get the address out of him to find where he was. You know, well, where are you? I'm here. I'm ready. And he kept changing the plan and changing where he was. And when I finally did get to the address and get to him, he was noticeably intoxicated. And that spiraled that evening into the first aggressive and abusive lash out that I'd ever seen. So he, that night, had a fight with one of his best friends, accused me of looking at his best friend. He called me so many names that night and I was just so taken aback. It's the first time I'd ever seen this side. I was a bitch. I was a slut. You know, don't you look at him. You're meant to be here with me. And this was all created in his head. This was all, I mean, everybody at this place that we were at was like, what the hell are you doing? Like, it was all in his own head. This abuse and his behavior was always worse with alcohol. He would become abusive and violent or threaten violence. Or another time he said, oh, you know, I'll come and stay for the weekend. And so I was like, okay. And I got all ready, turned up, got to the driveway, and he said, oh, no, messaged me. No, I don't want to see you tonight. You'll have to come back tomorrow. And oh, so I'm sitting outside of his house all ready for this weekend that he's promised me with all these trips. We're going to go, you know, here, we're going to go there, we're going to go and eat at this nice market and we'll do this. And then all of a sudden, last minute, I'd be outside the house and he would call it off, which would, you know, obviously leave me devastated. And I realized that it was because a lot of it, he was still promising the same things to the mother of his children. So he was stringing her along also. So the mother of his kids actually reached out to me around this time to warn me, to ask who I was. And I said, well, I'm Leighton's girlfriend. Of course, she was like absolutely in disbelief. She's like, well, the reason that he's not living with me anymore, and it turned out they had split up quite not long ago at all, was because he had assaulted her and she had finally made him leave the family home. So this is why he had moved back to my hometown, because his partner had kicked him out. So she warned me about the assault that he had assaulted her, about how manipulative he was, that she had experienced years and years of lying and cheating and abuse. And in her words, he had destroyed her life. And of course, this came as like a massive shock. But at the same time, he was so good. You know, when I said, what is this? He was just so good at explaining his way out of things, and that, you know, this is just her way of being spiteful and for me finally moving on and escaping her. Like, these are the things he would say. This is just her way of wanting to hold me there. Like, she just doesn't want me to move on. He told me that she was using his kids as a way of stopping us being together. He would often leave me, which would break me down, and then come back and blame the mother of his children, saying, oh, she said I couldn't see the children if we were together, and that's why I'm having such trouble. You know, that's why I keep going back to her. It's not because I love her at all. It's because she is using the kids. And here I am over here. I've had absolutely no experience with this type of thing. And I'm thinking, oh, this poor guy, you know, like, she's really, really using these children as a way of stopping him moving forward. It's not that I didn't believe her, but I thought, typical, this woman doesn't want him to move on. She's told me the story to ward me off being with him. These early games and this sort of this love bombing and then leaving and then love bombing again and blaming the mother of his children for why. But it really played into my sympathy towards him. And I really wanted to help him get part custody of his children. And I wanted to help him move forward. And, you know, because I am a giving person, I really, really wanted to make this work. At this time, I also became quite sick. So I had had some high-grade cells removed from my cervix a couple of years previously. It returned. So I was diagnosed with cervical cancer. I just felt really, really stuck. I couldn't return back home. My marriage was over. My family in this time were very mad with me. They noticed a big change in me. And my family were disapproving of this relationship. So I felt like I didn't have anybody that I could reach out to or go anywhere. I felt really trapped. I was aware at this point that I thought I'd maybe made a mistake, but I didn't want to admit that to myself. And I almost felt like I had to make this work because it had caused so much stress within my family. It was like I kind of had this point to prove. And by the time I moved in there and I was feeling trapped and he'd been playing all these emotional games with his ex or the mother of his children, I had hopes of like developing a 50-50 care situation with my children, but I realized pretty soon that it was not a safe environment for them to be in. He was not kind to his own children when he did have them, which I hated, absolutely hated. He used to taunt his son, was rough, quite rough in dealing with them, would yell and speak to them very, very cruel. He used to say things to me like, do you love me more than your kids? Which is a question he put to me once. And I remember like just the color draining from my face. Like I couldn't believe in that moment that someone would ever be so sick as to ask that question. And of course I said, well, no, I don't love anything more than my children. Or he told me he loved me more than his children, which I found just, I tried to explain to him, it's a different kind of love, Leighton. There's room for both. That's not something that you can pit. This is a romantic love and that's a maternal love and there's enough room for both. You don't, what kind of cool, sick question is that? But he would almost test me more and more with these questions. And when his ex had reached out to me earlier on, she had told me that he had assaulted her and that he'd also sexually assaulted her during this assault. And, you know, he'd said how ridiculous it was, that it was consensual. And he also liked to brag about being violent to other women he'd been with. Like he said, his ex through high school, he'd booted his ex with his foot in the leg out of the car once, and that it had left this bruise on her leg, the size of like her entire thigh. And that years later, he had reached out and apologized to her. But he also like made light of this. Like we were just, you know, we were teenagers and it was, you know, we were silly, we were drunk, we were young. I remember this one time as well. I was going through some photos because I feel like I was consistently trapped in his bedroom because he worked night shifts and he wanted me there 24/7, wanted to know where I was. So I was stuck in this bedroom. And so I would sit some days and I would go through photos of my family who I, you know, missed. And I went past a picture of me and my mum. And I said, oh, you know, look, there's me and my mum. And he said, fucking ugly. And I turned to him and I said, what did you just say? And he said, nothing. What? I said, why did you just say that? He said, you're fucking nuts. He said, you're nuts. I didn't say anything. And I really sat there and I really, even though I knew what I'd just heard with my own ears, I really questioned whether I had heard it or if I had not. I was starting to question my own clarity of mind and my own sanity because he was so convincing. Like, why would you say that and then look at me in my eyes and tell me I'm insane? It was like the slow but structured demise in my own mind. And he was getting angrier and meaner and more erratic and more cruel with the things he was saying. He would make comments about my appearance. My appearance had changed. He told me, this is how I want your hair. So I would go to the hairdresser and that's how I would have my hair. He would dictate what I wore. I lost a lot of weight due to both being physically unwell with my cervical cancer, but also just being desperately sad and depressed and the amount of anxiety that I had going on inside. Also, another thing he loved to do, he loved to threaten to cheat on me. He would love to do that. He would love to say, I could do so much better than you. You're a fucking ugly pig. He would threaten to go back to the mother of his kids, which he knew was a deep insecurity for me because it's something he'd done at the start. So he loved to play on that. He loved to make me feel unstable with threatening that. If I had, or I tried to leave and have a life outside of his bedroom, he would say that I'm not the partner he needed or wanted and that I should be home to tend to him, and that at least with the mother of his kids, he knew that she would always be home and never leave. So he loved to do a lot of comparing and pitting of me and other women. And yeah, he knew that that was a fear because he had lied in the beginning. Sex and intimacy was also really weaponized. It was the only source of positive attention that he ever gave me. So it was the only time he was ever nice to me was during sex. So I would hold on to this like brief reprieve from him being cruel and abusive. But then at the same time, he would weaponize it and withhold it and use this like physical affection as a cruel way to make me sad. Like he would, if I'd say something wrong, if I would bring up a topic that he didn't want to talk about, you know, like, why are you hiding this from me? Or why did you do that to me? Why did you say such a mean thing to me? He would withhold affection and withhold sex. This was another way that he could make me cry. And of course, then when I would cry, oh, one of the things he used to love to say to me, his favorite thing is, you're the most negative person I've ever met in my life. You're so negative, Jamie. You're so negative. I mean, I am not a negative person. You could ask any one of my family members, any one of my friends, and they will tell you that I am the lightest, warmest, kindest, fun-loving person. I am not a negative person. I really am not. And this is, he used to say this to me every day. There was no time or attentiveness or patience. It was just everything on his watch and everything else was negative. And I was being just made to believe that I was just this horrible, negative, ugly, unworthy person. In terms of the sexual intimacy and stuff, I think it also led to me doing things sexually I wasn't necessarily comfortable doing sometimes, because if I could please him and make him happy, he might be nicer to me and I would have a better day. I was in this constant need to keep him happy. Otherwise, my life would be shit. He was jealous, like jealous of my friends, of my Facebook following, of how many likes I would get on pictures. He was jealous of how affectionate I was with my children. He was jealous of closeness with my family members. My eldest son, he really had this thing in my head that he was naughty. And anybody who knows my oldest boy is just not. He's not. He's the most sweet, loving, just such a great kid. And he would be quite jealous, I think, of the affection and that I gave my children. When he would start to think that he'd pushed me too far and that I was possibly going to leave, you know, that he'd been so cruel that I was going to leave, he would like panic and do something big and dramatic and elaborate. Like he got my name tattooed on the back of his arm. He got my face one time tattooed on the back of his leg. He bought an engagement ring and asked me to marry him. Like, which at the time I had a hard time as well, understanding if you didn't love someone, why would you do these things? I had nobody left. Nobody really understood this control. And everybody was really angry at me, with good reason. I'd let people down. I'd lost my integrity. You know, I'd shut people out. I hadn't messaged people back for months. I just was so embarrassed of how I was living and the mental state I was at, that I was too ashamed to reach out and talk to anybody. I hated who I'd become. I really did. I hated myself at that time. I lost friends, lost family. And, you know, I would be frustrated too if it were a friend or a family of mine. I really would. I was just totally isolated and stuck with him, locked in this bedroom every day. And then I was really miserable and I found out, I kind of had waited till he'd gone to sleep and I checked his phone, which is another thing that's not healthy. You shouldn't be having to do that in relationships. I'd found him adding girls on Snapchat, just random females. And once again, he had become quite secretive about his communication with the mother of his children. And this is when I kind of finally left him, because it came to a head, because I confronted him that day and was met with like this massive amount of anger and verbal abuse, screaming in my face, threatening to punch me in the throat. My sister turned up to try and help me get out of there that day, and he threatened he was going to punch my sister's teeth out. And I was scared and I knew something bad was going to happen. So I left. I properly left him. I was just an absolute mess inside and out. My body was shutting down. I shook all day. I shook all day, constantly. I had anxiety attacks constantly. I jumped at like the slightest sound. A door would close and I'd jump. I cried all day. I couldn't sleep. And when I did
use medication to sleep. I would wake in fright like several times through the night. I'd been with him for only 8 or 9 months, but it did just destroyed me physically and mentally. I was just such a shell of who I was. My mum thought I was going to die. She really did. She said, "Jamie, you're going to die. You know, if you keep going, you're going to die." I was so skinny. I couldn't eat. The only time I would sleep was when I drank a bottle of wine and pass out. I was obsessive about checking my phone. It had become like an obsession. And I was so hypervigilant about anything to do with my phone, like completely obsessed with checking my phone. And in this time, you know, even though he had threatened to hurt me and punch me in the throat and he was calling me names more often and just seemed like he hated me, he would call me and call me off different numbers. He created different email addresses, begging me to come back. He even messaged me on Pinterest, which is just blew my mind. I didn't even know that you could message on Pinterest. Just all of these different ways he was trying to get me back, to rope me back, to come back. With all the promises, of course, you know, "I'm so sorry that I know that I've been mistreating you. I'll do anything to get you back. I'll go to the Men for Nonviolence course," you know, which he did, I believe. I do believe he did a few weeks of the course to try and prove to me as well that he was, you know, "I want to do this and I'm in the worst health I've ever been in, just terrible." I didn't know what to do. I was in such a bad place. I didn't know if I was ever going to feel okay again. This was for a couple of weeks I was like this. And this one day I got a call from him. He asked me if I would please meet him to talk. And my mum had gone away for the weekend. I was back living with her and my brother. And my mum had gone away for the weekend. She'd needed a break from me. I mean, she'd said that to me. "I need some space from you for a weekend. I need a break. I can't watch you be sad anymore. I can't watch you do this anymore." And while it, you know, it hurt to hear because I just did not want to be alone. I was so scared to be alone. I didn't trust myself. I didn't want to cave and go back, but I was so broken. I knew that it was a possibility that I would, but there's only so much one person can do. And she's just like, "Look, I have to go away for a weekend. I need a breather." And he knew that my mum had gone away. And so I think that's why he decided to kind of chip away at me, because he knew that I was pretty vulnerable and alone. He convinced me to go down the end of the driveway, and I was going to go with him in his car. But I got in that car and immediately the mood shifted. And he locked the car doors and he drove off away from my driveway. And he said, "I fooled you. I tricked you. I got you into the car. Now give me your phone." And I said, "No, I'm not giving you my phone." And that's when he started speeding, driving so fast, so erratically, swerving, screaming at me that I was a fucking liar. "You're a fucking liar," because that's another thing he loved to do. He loved to accuse me of cheating on him all the time when I never was. And in reality, he was the one that was cheating on me the whole time. He was punching the steering wheel, which was scaring the shit out of me. I'd never, ever seen him this angry. And I actually asked him, I said, have you taken something? You know, because there was that much anger that I thought, maybe he's on meth. Like, maybe he's taken something, because this level of rage was just terrifying. And he took me back to his house. And I'm not really sure how we got from the car into the home, but I was terrified and my phone had gone flat on the drive. So I had no access to my phone. I couldn't call my brother who was at home. I couldn't call him for help.
he calmed down and we got into the house. And then we got into the bedroom and he shut the door and he snatched my phone off me. And as I tried to get it back, that's when he took his first hit and he smacked me in the side of my head. We then wrestled as I was trying to get my phone back and he strangled me for the first time. He strangled me over the next hour, 3 times in total. I don't know if you know what it's like to be strangled, but it's a truly terrifying experience. So he put his hands, you know, obviously I was down on the bed and he put his hands around my throat. And the pressure was so intense that I thought it was going to crush my windpipe. And everything went dark. I lost control of my bladder. And then when he thought maybe I was out, he let go. And so I started fighting to try and get him off me. And that's when he strangled me a second time. But this time he put his one hand around my throat, one hand over my mouth and my nose so I couldn't breathe. And I nearly passed out again. I was panicking and the only thing I could do was try to bite his leg as he had both of my arms pinned down with both of his legs. And as I bit him, he took his fingers and he put them on my eyes and he gouged my eyes inward. And I thought my eyes were going to pop out. I didn't know if I would ever see properly again in that moment. At one point, he had me face down on the bed with my hand behind my back, my left arm. And he was telling me, you know, I'm going to fucking snap your arm. I'm going to fucking snap your arm. And I did think he was going to break my arm. So I tried to move and he grabbed hold of my hand and I felt my finger snap on my left hand, my small finger. And I turned around and immediately I knew it was broken. I knew it straight away and I held it out to him and I said, look, what you've done, you've broken my hand. And he laughed at me. He grabbed my hand, my finger, and he wrenched it forward as like a to make it hurt more. He then strangled me for a third time. And I really thought that he said to me, I'll fucking kill you. I'm going to fucking kill you. And I thought, okay, I really am going to die here if I don't just conform. He was taunting me emotionally throughout this entire thing. He was laughing at me and he told me about all the women that he had been having sex with while we were together. And then he proceeded to get on top of me and rape me. And I was sobbing. And I told him no. And he told me that I didn't really mean that. And I went catatonic and I froze. And I just remember I couldn't move. And I just let it happen because I knew it was my best chance of getting out of that room alive. And so I played along. I went very quiet and pretended to go to sleep. And as he worked night shifts, he went off to work and he basically said to me, laughing at me as he was leaving the room, well,
I guess I'll fucking see you when I'm home. And if you're not here, don't ever fucking speak to me again. And he was telling me while he was raping me too that he wanted me home all the time and I was never going to leave again. You never fucking go anywhere. You've got to be right fucking here. And then he left. And I knew my phone was dead. So I had no way of calling for help. So I heard his car leave. And I ran. I ran into the road out in front of his house. I waved a car down. And this man, this lovely man stopped and told me to get in. And he wanted to take me to the police station. He was like, please, you've got to let me take you to the police station. And I said, no, please take me home. I knew that my brother was there and I just wanted to get home. And once I was home, my brother called the police and then the police arrived. And obviously I was taken straight to hospital because I was, even though I thought I was fine, I was not fine. I was in a really bad way. I found out later, because he only worked about 5 minutes away from home, from his home address. And I found out later that he had actually come back. So he had only gone to work for about 10 minutes or so and then had left and raced back home to try and find me. In the time period that I got back home, I put my phone on charge and then my brother was frantic running around, what's happened? What the hell has happened to you? Obviously, I was bleeding everywhere. I had bruises everywhere. My hand was clearly broken. I charged my phone and I started, you know, I called the police and we were waiting for them to arrive. And this time, I was getting phone call after phone call after phone call from him, emails from him begging for forgiveness and apologizing. Please talk to me. Please, I'm so sorry. It scares me to know that, you know, he came back. So what might have happened had he driven back and seen me on the road? He could have run me over, could have finished off the job. Anyway, when he realized that I wasn't answering, he ran away that night off to his ex-partner's house, which is a good hour and a half away. He ran away like a little coward back to the mother of his children. And she let him back, of course, because she's also a victim of his manipulation and abuse. And from there, I went up to the hospital and they took all accounts of my injuries and I put a cast on my hand, but they said I was going to have to come back the next day and have a surgery. And then from there, we went straight to me and my sister. She was with me. We went straight to the sexual health clinic where they deal with all the rape kits and everything else. And I will always remember this. Sorry. Dr. Kate. I will always remember her for as long as I'm alive. She walked around the corner, this lady, and she was dressed head to toe in yellow, in this flowing yellow dress. And she just emitted this beautiful, glowing kindness. And Dr. Kate was the sexual health doctor who did all of the rape kit for me. And I remember her so vividly and so specifically from that day. She represented everything lovely in myself that I had lost. And she was so beautiful and she was so kind. And that moment of seeing her will always be a pivotal moment of my life. It really restored my faith that there was still hope for me. And she was just so lovely. I've never met a person more fitting for her job, dealing with rape victims and sexual assault victims on their worst day of their life. And she was just such a brightness. And I'm so grateful for her. And I'm hopeful that one day maybe I'll get to tell her what an impact she made on such a dark time. Later then, he handled himself in 24 hours later. I think his mother got in contact with him up at his mother of his children's place and said, "Layton, you have to come home. The police want to speak to you." And he handed himself in. And he was charged with 3 counts of strangulation, grievous bodily harm for breaking my hand, assault with intent for all of the other, punching, gouging my eyes, all of the bruises all over my arms, and then obviously rape. So he was sent to prison straight away. He was denied bail at his first hearing. However, after 4 or 5 weeks or so, he was granted electronically monitored bail at an address not in our city, thankfully. It's a couple of hours away. He wasn't allowed here. He wasn't allowed to leave the address. And with this came a 2-year bloody brutal waiting game to go to trial. And this 2 years waiting to go to trial was just some of the worst times, even worse than the night of the assault. Obviously, him and his ex-partner, they rekindled their relationship. You know, he needed her, and this was everything that she soaked up because he was able to manipulate her. I was now the enemy, and they were a team. And the online crusade of bullying was just so intense. I was abused online. I was actually physically assaulted by his cousins when I was out one night. I received so many hateful messages from his family, his cousins, from his partner, the mother of his children, which I never understood because she went through the exact same thing. And now she's supporting him instead of supporting my story. Really, truly, I felt like I was on trial for the 2 years. He got to scurry away and hide like a little rat. And I had to face this every single day with my broken hand and my children going into a supermarket, facing people who wanted to hurt me because I was telling the truth on this man. So many lies spread about me. There were horrible pictures and posts made about me on social media. I had a really, really fantastic detective who I'm still in contact with now, who was such a support. Honestly, I could not have asked for a more supportive detective to be supporting me through this 2 years. And he seized all of his, the mother of Layton's child, they actually seized all of her electronic property at one point because of the things that were being posted. And she got warned that, you know, if she was to continue posting these things, that she would be arrested and charged with interfering with a criminal proceeding. I think in this time period, the aftermath of the assault, I was just so desperate for people to believe me. They sabotaged you know, any relation, anyone I would try and start dating, eventually they would sabotage that. And it was just like this smear campaign. Seriously, it was so, so awful. And then I met this beautiful man, Ben, who is now my fiance. And he was like a ray of sunshine that came into my life and my children's life. And he really supported me and my children the whole way through this time. He went through the trial with me, so did my mum, and so did one of my best friends. And I'm so grateful for that. So I went through this 2 years of waiting to go to trial, and a week before the trial, Leighton and his lawyers tried to cut me a deal that he would plead guilty to the 3 strangulation charges, GBH and the assault, if I dropped the rape charge, which I was not having a bar of it, because at that point, I really didn't care at that point what the outcome of the trial was. I had been dragged through the fire while this little prick has been hiding away with the safety net of his family that protects him and his bullshit. So whatever the result, I wanted him to have to face it. I wanted him to have to face it and face me like I had every day. In saying that, though, the trial was brutal, almost worse than the night of the assault. Because now, you know, not only being shamed and victim blamed by Leighton and his family, I'm now being blamed and victim shamed by a professional lawyer who's undermining and degrading me, while I'm trying to be brave sitting in the courtroom in front of my abuser. That was a grueling experience. I was on the stand for 2 days. And honestly, I think that my mum, my partner Ben, and my friend Kirsty is the person who sat with me in the court. She's an extremely strong and supportive person. And she couldn't interact with me the entire time. You're not allowed to look at me. You're not allowed to touch me. You're not allowed to talk. You just have to be present, sit there, listen. And I just have to know that she's there. That's the support person can't do anything. And she is so strong. And I just remember the last time leaving the stand and exiting that building, she just burst into tears, and we both just burst into tears in the hallway. And I don't think I've ever seen my friend cry like that. But it's a lot to take in, you know, having to sit there, listen to all these horrible details, because they do. Lawyers go into detail. They want to hurt you. They want to trip you up. They want to shame you. They want to minimize it. They want to make you look terrible. And it was just, yeah, it was a lot. So yeah, the court process was not for the faint-hearted. They had to drag me to the door each time. Mum on one side, Ben on the other, and they had to literally drag me to the court entrance, because I don't think I could have done it. During this time, you know, leading up to the trial, another thing that's quite telling, I actually did a boxing match in the time that I was waiting to go to trial with my hand broken. Well, my hand was recovering, but it's never going to be okay, like 100% again. But I did a boxing match, and honestly, I don't know why. I kind of feel like everything was hard and everything hurt, so I was kind of trying to throw myself into as much as I could to stop myself from having to think about what was coming up. It was really hard, and I was left feeling quite deflated at the end of the experience of the boxing, and I couldn't see the lesson. And I remember my partner Ben saying, "You're going to see the lesson in this one day. Like, you did it. And I don't know, you might not be able to see it right now, but you're going to see it." And then after the trial, I realized that the lesson was I would rather do 1,000 boxing matches than ever have to go through this experience ever again. So I do think it kind of mentally prepared me for the fight that I had against Leighton. They do warn you with these kinds of situations. Juries are fickle. It was a jury, and juries can be fickle. And a lot of the time, it's hard to prove rape. It's hard. It's hard to prove it. It's my word against his, and all they have to have is one person that doubts that, and that's it. Fortunately, he was found guilty on all of his charges, which was just incredible. So I was so incredibly grateful to this jury. Sentencing was then in a couple of months down the track. So he got sent to prison, and sentencing, I had the option of whether I wrote something and someone read it out on my behalf, or I could be there and read it myself. And in true Jamie style, I decided to take the hard option and I went in person, which was another extremely intimidating experience. There were 25 odd members of his family, and there were 5 of us. And of course, you lose all of your rights, like, to protection when you're no longer on trial. It's an open courtroom. So I had to be up amongst his family with the mother of his children there, who had harassed me online for 2 years at this point, longer, 2.5 years. His family members were calling out names, calling me a tramp, a bitch, just abusing me while I walked up there. Anyway, I did sit there and I read my statement proudly, and then I decided that I was ready to go. I didn't stay to hear the sentencing. I read my bit. Layton didn't turn up to court in person. He opted for video conference. So that's another telling aspect of his personality. Once again, just a coward, hiding away. Didn't want to be there to look me in my eye. I would like to read it out, my victim impact statement, because I thought long and hard about what I was going to say to him. And even though he wasn't there, he had to be there via video, so I know he heard me. And of course, while I was reading it out, there was the comments flying from the back, and I got paused a couple of times. A couple of people of his family got removed from the court because they were misbehaving so badly while I was trying to speak. So I'm going to read this out. And what I had to say to him was, "The months I spent with Layton Lacey, while not long, were the worst months of my entire life to date. From the moment you entered my life, chaos, lies, and hurt ensued. And the psychological games never stopped right up until the night of the 10th of February 2021. Yours was an insidious type of abuse. It crept in slowly and broke me from the inside out, and then left me with a broken body and a shattered spirit. I lost more in the short time I spent with you than I ever have in my entire life. Your ability to take what you want, when you want it, and then to discard a woman when you're finished sucking the light and love out of them is disgusting and destructive, and it left me a shell of who I was before I met you. The night of the 10th of February, 2021, I thought I was going to die. With your hands around my throat and the darkness closing in, all I could see were the faces of my little boys. And all I could hear was my mum's voice. She had warned me so many times before, 'He's going to hurt you, Jamie.' And Jessica, who had warned me of your violence also. And here it was happening to me. Not only did I think I was going to die at your hands that night, you also ended the assault with the ultimate infraction of my dignity and respect by raping me. Once again, showing that you take what you want when you want, without absolutely no regard for the pain you inflict on the woman you do it to. Your actions have greatly affected my life. My body shut down for a long period of time. I was unable to sleep without medication. And when I did sleep, I would wake up screaming and crying with night terrors of your face. I lost a lot of weight. I couldn't eat, and I shook constantly all day. I am still afraid to leave my home, and I am always on high alert every time I do so. Scanning the room before entering has become common practice for me, and I don't think the anxiety will ever fully go. I wear the scar of your assault every day on my hand, a hand that will most likely never regain full function or movement. a hand that my little boys hold and kiss, and are also reminded of every single day when they reach out to hold it. My biggest regret is the time that this stole from my beautiful little boys. They suffered because their mum was destroyed, and they deserve their mum to be happy and healthy. I am so proud today that I have worked so hard to be the best I can be for them, and that I have regained their trust and respect. They have their mum back, and I will never again let anyone steal that from them. Even after everything, I like to think I have remained soft-natured and kind. I don't believe in revenge or tit for tat or an eye for an eye. I have no room or capacity for hate. Karma, I think, is questionable at best. I think we are presented with choices in life, and we either learn the lesson or we don't. And then life will test you by continuing to present the same issue in different ways or different people or different faces until you choose to learn the lesson. Maybe this is one of those moments for you, Leighton, and hopefully this time you will choose to learn the lesson. You have daughters who need you to show them how a man is supposed to treat a lady, and sons who need you to be a role model for being a good man. If not for yourself, learn the lesson for them. He got sentenced to 11 and a half years, but he will serve 9 years, 9 months. I went into this relationship with pure intentions. All I ever wanted to do was love him and be loved. That was it. I didn't want anybody to get hurt. I didn't want anything bad to happen. When I did get with Ben and, you know, finally found someone who loved me, I had comments from his family, you know, like, oh, wow, you're such a rape victim. You're, you know, out there moving on. Well, I've wasted enough time on somebody who didn't love me and didn't treat me right. I was locked in a room for 8 to 9 months. I've done my time. I don't want to sit alone anymore. I'm not going to let it. Someone else's actions affect the way I live the rest of my life. And yeah, I just feel like I've had my spirit stumped out enough. I refuse to live being a victim. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to. I will grieve privately the way that I do it. And I have. Trust me, it is a roller coaster. It is not a straight line. You don't get to the pinnacle one day and go, oh, I'm healed. It is great days and then a really shit day. Or it's fine and then it's just not. For no reason. Honestly, talking about it, for me, is one of the best things. Being listened to, talking about it, and the differences, I suppose, from the beginning of this journey to now, is there was such a desperation to be believed when this assault had happened because of all of the things that were being said about me. You know, she's a liar. I was told I was faking cancer, faking my illness. Everything that you could possibly imagine has been said about me. Everything. So I had such this desperation to be believed. And now I couldn't give two shits. I couldn't give two shits who believes me and who doesn't, because the people that matter do. And the court did. Those 12 people did. And that's reflected. He's in jail. I was able to make amends with my family. And most importantly, my children have forgiven me. They lost their mum, and that is my biggest regret, is that they suffered and they lost time with me because I was stuck in this horrible, horrible mess of a relationship. And I think just on the whole, like, you can't outrun your trauma. And actually, since it's been nice and quiet and I've been getting on with my life, with my children and my fiance, and we're doing really, really well. And me and my now partner have just bought our home. We own our home. with like the most small mortgage that you could ever possibly want. So we're nearly mortgage free. We're getting married. Life can change.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
When I sat down with Jamie, I wanted to know how her early experiences with abuse impacted the rest of her life.
One of the biggest things I've learned is you can't outrun your trauma. It will catch you at some point unless you face it and you deal with it. It happened to me. I went through this period of life thinking I was unscathed from the traumas of my childhood, and then it sat me on my ass.
And that definitely has lasting effects. I went through my whole life thinking that it didn't affect me. I really did. I really thought, no, you know, I actually felt quite sorry for this person. But I think as I've got older, I've learned that kind of like my value in myself has sort of been based on this first sexual encounter, which was non-consensual and, you know, like an assault. And I think that definitely sets your self-worth, like you hold your worth in your sexual prowess as a woman. You know, we're really in a healthy young mind. That should not come into it as much. And my parents, look, I'm actually very lucky. I've got a great relationship with both of them these days.
I also asked her to elaborate on how this predator identified and exploited her vulnerabilities.
And I truly think that Layton and other predators like him, they can smell that shit from a mile away. Like, really, I was just the perfect victim for somebody like that. Just the absolute perfect candidate for falling into this trap. Absolutely. It was like I lived this amazing life. I had traveled. I had these beautiful children. I owned property. Like, honestly, this is not where I thought my life was going to head. And it's like he saw me. He liked the way I made him look, but he was so jealous of everything about me that he wanted to suck that from me. And he did. He sucked it. He sucked everything I loved about myself. He took from me my ability to be a mom. I am again now, but you know, I prided myself on being such a fantastic mum. I was such a loyal family member and friend and just such a great spirit. And he just stole it. Even my looks for that time, he was able to suck the way I felt about myself, the how I looked, my hair, what I wore. Everything was changed. Everything was damaged. He was losing the grip. He was losing the grip on me. I had left. I wasn't conforming to this role that he wanted me to be. And it was like his final tantrum almost, if that makes sense. It was like, well, I'm losing the grip here. If that's the case, I'm going to ruin you. I'm going to ruin the way you look. I'm going to hurt you because I've lost control of this situation. And that's what happens when abusers do. They say that the most dangerous time is when you leave an abuser, and it truly, truly is. So I left him once before I left in the end. It can take a few times for a victim to leave an abuser, but I went back. And in that time, the first time I left, I was just as miserable and messed up, and it wasn't good. And I did have someone reach out to me then who said that he had been this way the whole way through high school, that she knows that he had mistreated women all through school. He would take
girls' virginities, sleep with women, and then have nothing to do with them. He would be physically abusive. He was in trouble with the police. So this was a pattern. Like, I had warning. People had warned me. I do know of one other person as well who he's done this to. However, this person hasn't reached out to me, and I wouldn't want to. They have a life and a partner and things like that. So I wouldn't want to drag up for anything for anybody that they don't want to talk about. There's nothing scary about him. What's scary about him is his depth of manipulation. Because I talk about the night, and the night is horrific. What he did to me was horrific. And I know I'm not the first person he's done this to. I know that there are other women he's done this to. But the damage he had done to me leading up to the assault was, in a way, so much worse. The mental torture was the worst aspect of this experience for me. The wounds I have mostly healed from. My hand, you know, I live with a massive scar. I've had two surgeries on my hand because my knuckle is in the wrong place and will always be. But, you know, what scares me the most is how terrifying the mental abuse can be, what it can do to somebody.
Also, what does she wish some people would understand about the complexity of recovering from abuse?
If I could give you a dollar for the amount of times people have said, oh, yeah, you can move on now. You can get back to your normal life now. What does life look like now? What do you mean I can get back to my normal life? My life is completely different. The last time my life was normal, I was married on a farm. I'm not there anymore. Everything's changed. Like, and that really got to me when people said, yeah, you can forget about this now and get back to life. I don't even know what my life, well, this was back, you know, back then when it had all dust had settled. What is my life now? What does my life look like now? But I think like people say things like that with out of genuine kindness. They genuinely are trying to be lovely, but it's like, I had a couple of people say it and it actually made me really mad. I was like, well, you tell me then. You tell me what normal is now. Like, go on then. Tell me, what is life? What is normal for me now? Because I don't know. I sure as hell don't know. And it really rattled me, like, that comment. But then, you know, people aren't doing it to be mean. They're saying it because they want to be supportive.
Now that she's survived and begun to heal, what is she most grateful for in her life today?
I'm just very grateful for the people that I had. I'm grateful for the people that left. I'm grateful for the people that stayed. But my family, my mum was just, I wouldn't have got through it without her. Absolutely not. I think I nearly half killed her during the process with stress. I'm very, very grateful. I didn't get to grieve the end of my marriage. It was consumed by this toxic person who came swooping in. So I never got to grieve the end of that. I didn't give the end of my marriage the respect that it deserved. And I didn't give my ex-husband the respect that he deserved at the end of that marriage. He is a great guy. A great dad. And geez, he really stepped up during this time. He knew I was not okay. And it hurt him deeply that I had moved on so fast. I know that it hurt him deeply. And I hate that because he had been my best friend for nearly a decade. So that is really important as well. You know, he stepped up, stood in the gap for our children in this time and actually really challenged me. Like, said, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? He said to me at one point, I think you're punishing yourself. I think this is what you think you deserve because of your childhood. And I said, do you really think that? He said, yes, I do. Like, you, what are you doing? This is not you. He was so frustrated. Everybody was. Everybody was really frustrated. But I can say he was a great partner for the time we were together and a fantastic dad and still is. And we have a very good relationship today, me and my boy's dad. So we've been able to overcome that. So that's quite cool. And he's happy. He's moved on. He's got a great partner. That's how it should look. You know, that's how a healthy separation looks. That's how it should be.
And finally, how is she able to communicate with her children about the trauma she's lived through?
But I don't hide anything from my children.
they know. They know everything. They know what happened. And we talk about it. We talk about it as much or as little as they want. I will never, ever stop them asking questions or trying to understand, because they need to. They deserve to know. They want to know why, what happened. How did this happen? Well, I'm going to give you the most honest answer that I can. And their forgiveness has been the biggest thing to me. I don't think they ever, they, doesn't matter what you do. Your kids always love you, but getting their trust back again, that they know, like they know now, no matter what was to happen, who it was, that would never happen again. That's never going to happen again. That we are so strong as a little unit. Like even with my fiance, who we adore and the kids absolutely adore, I've said to them countless times, if he wasn't here tomorrow, we'll still be okay. You know, like the love of God, if something happened between me and my fiance, I say to them, it's me and it's us three for life. You know that, right? Like, that's never going away. We're unshakable.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Jamie grew up in a home where appearances masked painful truths. Behind closed doors, abuse and manipulation were constant. Over time, she became accustomed to mistreatment and lies, which left her emotionally vulnerable and deeply isolated. It shaped how she saw herself and others, eventually leading her to a pivotal crossroads. That's when a predator entered her life. Within just 9 months, things spiraled out of control, bringing her to the brink of death. And when everything was falling apart, there was no one she felt she could turn to. Even after escaping, Jamie's struggle didn't end. She faced victim blaming and endured a grueling legal process. But through it all, she found strength. She chose to speak out, to heal, and to hold her abuser accountable. Jamie's story is one of unimaginable pain, but also of powerful resilience. She didn't just survive. She faced her trauma head on. She did the hard work. She rejected shame, broke the silence, and stood up to fear. And in doing so, she began to heal. She also learned a lasting truth. You can't outrun your trauma, but you can face it and begin to reclaim your life. Until next time, I'm Jake Deptula, and this is Love, Lust, Fear. Every guest featured on Love, Lust, Fear selects a charity or organization to share. Please check the show notes on this episode for more details. If you or someone you know is being abused by a partner, there is help available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline provides essential tools and support to help survivors of domestic violence. Just call 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. Or you can text START to 88788. If you'd like to be a guest on Love, Lust, Fear and share your personal dating or relationship story, you can email us at lovelustfearpod@gmail.com or DM us on Instagram at lovelustfearpod. Disclaimer, the information shared on this podcast should not be considered as professional advice or a substitute for seeking professional advice.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playmcd.com for full details and amoe.playmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.